Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 29th of September, 2013. This is Nav Briefing number 88, and the title is, The Terma is a Tray. So here we are on the next to the last day of September 2013. This would be day 24 of the shift of Shodashi, which began on the 6th of September this year. So we're just coming off the hinge, that is to say the last quarter of the moon, which I enjoyed and all of us enjoyed over Thursday and Friday of last week. You know, the hinge is normally a time in planetary tantra when you can observe an easy access to that subliminal level of your own mind, in which the enlightenment of your mind speaks to you. All of you have the enlightened mind. All of you have the Buddha mind. And in fact, there is no difference between the Buddha mind and your ordinary mind. That's not a proposition that I'm making up just to give you a bit of a thrill, but it's a well-known proposition that you encounter in Chan and Zen Buddhism, or what are called the non-attainment teachings, which, by the way, are the only kind worth considering. One way to state that proposition is by way of a paradox, which is also not of my invention, but it's a well-known paradox that you encounter in those traditions. What is the difference between the ordinary mind and the Buddha mind? Well, to the person who resides in the ordinary mind, they can't see the difference. And to the person who resides in the Buddha mind, there is no difference to see. This is non-attainment teaching. And I just want to point out regarding our practice in planetary tantra that the solutions that come at the hinge, that is to say around the 21st or 22nd day of every shift, are solutions that come from that paradox. There are actually moments each month, or every moment of the day, but in some peculiar way they happen each month due to the cadence of the Earth itself. There are moments at the shift when you can become suddenly enlightened. And the nature of this enlightenment is cognitive enlightenment. That is to say, it is not a realization necessarily about the absolute and ultimate nature of mind without content. Rather, it tends to be a cognitive realization, or to put it in plain English, an insight, an enlightened insight, a brilliant or dazzling insight, and it comes easily and quickly during that interval of the shift that is timed by the last quarter of the moon. To put it in even plainer English, use the word flash. You get a flash of enlightenment, a flash of insight. And these flashes, of course, can come at any time during the 28-29-day Dakini cycle. You know, the lunar Shaktis, as they're called, the cycles of the moon, the monthly cycles of the moon, timed from one new moon to the next, are really indications of emotional weather. In planetary tantra, in the GNE, you learn to follow the emotional weather of the Earth. She has predictable moods. The Aeon Sophia in material immanence in this planet has predictable moods. And I call that emotional weather. And the emotions are the moods to be discerned during each of these shifts. And the emotional weather is the chaotic activity in the emotional body of the Earth itself, to which you can attune yourself by observing these cycles. So insights and flashes can come at any moment in these cycles. I've pointed out many times that almost instantaneously, within the first hours or even the first minutes of a new shift, dazzling insights keyed to the theme and nature of that Dakini on shift will flash up in your mind. That is because your mind is not yours. The biggest illusion that you have about your mind is that it is yours solely. Your mind is not your mind. Your mind is the mind of humanity. The whole human species has the same mind. We are of one mind. And the mind of humanity is in turn an expression or extension or projection of the mind of the Earth. The Aeon Sophia, before she became the Earth, designed the human species. She did so in a tantric act of coordination with another Aeon, Thelete. So Sophia and Thelete are, as it were, the cosmic parents of the human species. I don't like to use the word parent, however, and you know why. It's an analogy to biological reproduction. This is not really acceptable in Gnostic syntax. The manner in which Sophia and Thelete designed the human genome in the galactic center, and there's the answer to the origin of the human species, in case you were wondering. In my opinion, it's the only answer that you need. It's the only answer that works. The manner in which they designed us recalls the act of two musicians jamming together or two artists working on a project far more than it resembles sexual conjugation that produces a biological offspring. So we were not created by the human genome, the human species, the Anthropos was not created by Sophia and Thelete. It was emanated by them through the aeonic power of Ennoia, E-N-N-O-I-A. So now we find ourselves in the experiment that arose on a certain planet in the galactic arms. We are the 10th strain, or at the beginning at least of this experiment, humanity appeared as the 10th strain of the master template or genomic matrix, which is embedded in the Orion Nebula. Previous to life here on Earth, there were 9 other strains of humanity that went out from the Orion Nebula, radiating on mycelium threads of plasma, and seeded themselves in different planetary systems. 9 planetary experiments preceding this one. So currently, we are looking at the end of Anthropos 10 and the mutation into Anthropos 11. Now, as you find yourself in this experiment here on Earth, sitting in the setting of the experiment, in the actual laboratory setting, which is called nature, as you find yourself sitting there, you tend to think, as most human animals do, that because you can think and remember, because you have a personal history, And because, especially, you are conscious of yourself, that is, you have the ability of self-reflection, you tend to think that your consciousness is your own. Your mind is your own. Your mind is not your own. This is a great illusion. What is your own is your attention. Attention is your own. And when you use your attention to read your own mind, as it were, to follow the operations of your own mind, you naturally and automatically fall into the illusion that what you are attending to belongs uniquely to you, simply due to the fact that what you are using to attend to it does belong uniquely to you. So, for instance, here I am sitting, looking out the window of my upstairs navigator room, and I can see the hills in the distance and the clouds. I can see some vultures flying over the hills. And I am attending to the natural world around me. Now, the power of my attention is mine. I earned it. It belongs uniquely to me. No one else has John Lash's powers of attention. This is what Castaneda called, by an unfortunate turn of phrase, personal power. You know, Castaneda claimed that one of the main objectives of the sorcery practice that he learned was to accumulate personal power. The sorcerer attempts to accumulate personal power. This is an unfortunate use of language by Castaneda, because in fact, it's not personal at all. Now, here's another paradox. I say to you that the power of attention which I have to give to the natural world in front of me by act of perception, or to turn back upon myself and look into my memory or look into my own thoughts by way of an act of reflection, that power of attention is uniquely mine. And yet it is not personally mine. It is uniquely mine because I accumulated it. But it is not personally mine because attention is impersonal. So you have a certain quantity or power or caliber of intention, of attention, excuse me. I'm talking about attention now, not intention. The capacity to attend, either externally through perception or internally through reflection. Okay? And that capacity to attend is yours to the extent that you have uniquely accumulated it and honed it to operate in a certain way. So in that respect, Castaneda's term personal power applies. It is personal to you because you have personally acquired it. So the attention that I have, for instance, to look at the sky or to reflect upon the contents of my own mind differs from that of anybody else on this planet. But it is an impersonal faculty nonetheless, because attention is impersonal. So, you can consider, again, another parallel between Castaneda's Neo-Toltec sorcery and Planetary Tantra. In both cases, the acquisition and accumulation of, quote, personal power, in other words, attention, is imperative. It's basic to the process. Well, if you look in Castaneda's works, you find various techniques, various tests he underwent, and you find various clues and suggestions regarding how to build up, accumulate, and amplify your power of attention. And then when you look at planetary tantra in the GNA, you see very specific methods to do that same thing. And it gives me great delight to say that I think that the methods of augmenting attention in planetary tantra are simple and straightforward. For instance, observation of the lunar shaktis throughout the month. And that these methods have the advantage of being common to everyone. They're not idiosyncratic. Everyone uses the same methods to acquire and build attention so that your power of attention is stronger and stronger. And therefore, you are able to attend in ways that the ordinary person with weak powers of attention cannot do. You know, one of the sure signs that Anthropos 10 is on its way out is that due to the terrific onslaught of IT and computer technologies and prosthetic electronic devices to replace the mind, the memory, and the senses, due to that assault coming from the realm of the Archons, but thoroughly implemented by human beings who are in the service of the Archons, due to that assault, there has been an enormous damage has been inflicted upon human capacity for attention. Now, this was foreseen a long time ago by certain of the Asian mystics in the Kalika movement, following the era of the historical Buddha. So you'll find in the Mahanirvana Tantra, which is one of the few Kalika documents that ever snuck into print, that ever got written down, because Kalika teaching has been largely oral, you will find a very clear statement that says that in the last days of Kali Yuga, which is right now, that human attention span will be reduced to a few seconds. And so building up attention and being able to hold your power of attention at a high level of concentration with ease and delight is a sign of mutation to Anthropos 11, whereas those whose powers of attention are failing them have reached a geriatric level of complete failure to manage the minimal amount of attention it takes to live will necessarily fall away. Those animals will necessarily be eliminated. And even if they still continue to live, during the time that they live, they will not in fact be engaged with the earth and what's happening to the earth. They will simply live in a state of zombified oblivion. And of course, you know, the meme of the zombie looms large today in the collective unconscious. So the meme of the zombie is a Kali-esque meme. It's a Kali-esque theme or Kali-esque trope, if you will. And the illusion of that trope, the allusion, is to the state of mind that human animals reach when they no longer have any capacity to maintain their own attention. So you could say the fate of each human animal, depending on whether it goes down with Anthropos 10 or is carried forward into Anthropos 11, depends on how much power of attention that you have. Now, speaking of myself, my powers of attention have been cultivated in various ways over the years, obviously. And so in my personal power, to use Castaneda's phrase, by application of this impersonal capacity, I would add, I can attend to certain things that are happening on this planet. And with the assistance of genial species, powers of attention can be amplified exponentially. As you know, these telestic seances as I've said, these telestic seances produce an enormous amount of material. Why is that? Because they take the power of attention that I already have accumulated, and they raise it exponentially by a factor of who knows what. You know, not just two or three, but five or ten. And when you have a high capacity of attention already, and it's raised to a factor of 10 by the assistance of psychoactive chemistry provided by sacred plants, well, then you're attending to some pretty amazing events. And needless to say, you don't do that all the time, and you can't do it a lot. Because if you did, you wouldn't be able to function in the ordinary world, because your powers of attention would be so engaged in that non-ordinary world, which is just the part of the ordinary world that you don't normally see because you don't have enough attention to reach it. This whole model or paradigm of attention I'm presenting now can be found in a particular version in Goethe and in Goethean science. So if you read about Goethe's method of scientific investigation, you find that it describes exactly what I've been talking about here for the last 20 minutes. In Goethe's case, it has been called intensive perception. Goethe made the observation through his powers of attention, which were extraordinary, and had been cultivated rigorously all his life, he made the observation that when you perceive an object in nature, such as a rose, you tend to think that your senses bring to you the full content of that object. So you smell the rose, you touch the petals, you feel the texture, you look at the rose with your eyes, and you tend to think, all human animals tend to think, that the content of the senses that is being delivered into your consciousness presents to you the totality of that perceived object, the rose. But Goethe showed that that is not at all the case, and that what your senses present to you of any object in the natural world is only the outermost layer of what is involved in that object. And so Goethe proposed the method of intensive observation, which means that you use your attention to go intensively into what you are perceiving, to penetrate more deeply. And you can only do that by building up your power of attention. So why am I talking about this right now? Well, I'd like to get back to a particular insight that I had. I was talking about the flashes and insights that come on the hinge, and they're pretty wonderful. I can honestly say that every single hinge that's occurred in the last 2 years has brought some kind of definitive or releasing insight relative to the theme and the instruction of the Dakini on shift. It's really reliable. And I'm sure that there are those of you out there who would confirm that testimony. So I'd just like to share with you, for the pleasure of it, an insight that came to me on the hinge of Shirdashi. This insight concerns a word that I introduced a while back, endopsyche. Now I'm going to start using this word a lot now, endopsyche. What is the endopsyche? Well, the endopsyche is the subconscious of humanity. It has been called the collective unconscious by Jung. It is also called the unconscious, but I don't like this word unconscious because it's not unconscious. It is subconscious. And like the mind of the Anthropos, which is actually your mind and my mind, The endopsyche belongs to us all. The endopsyche is an aspect of the mind of the Anthropos. It's an aspect of the inner workings of the collective psyche of humanity. And so we can talk of endopsychic processes. And endo means within. So endopsyche means it's within the psyche. And that's also an interesting syntax, because the word within, in this case, can be said to indicate a double unfolding, a double enfoldment. The within, or endo part of endopsyche, indicates a double enfoldment. Your psyche contains the endopsyche of the entire human species. So when you look at what you call your psyche, that is your inner life, your inner stream of memories and feelings and moods and thoughts and reflections and so forth, when you look into that stream of consciousness, as it's been called in literary terms, it's as if you're looking through a circular window, like the porthole of a boat, into the ocean in which the boat is floating. So through the lens of your psyche, you look at the endopsyche. And your psyche is within the endopsyche. It is within that which it beholds. But equally so, the complete endopsyche is within your psyche. The complete endopsyche is the ocean outside the portal, which is actually in the mind of the observer looking through the porthole. Now, the teachings of the endopsyche belong to Shodashi. And they belong to what I've called Mayavada Vedanta. Mayavada Vedanta is the only metaphysics that can survive in Kali Yuga. It's the only metaphysics that you need to know. You will not find Mayavada Vedanta teachings written anywhere in the world, in any book, nor will you find any scholar or teacher on the internet presenting an exposition of Mayavada Vedanta. Why not? Because I invented it. And I'm the only one who can tell you what it is. Mayavada Vedanta is the threefold instruction that can be called metaphysical, if you wish. But it's the only metaphysics that the human mind needs to realize the ultimate nature of mind and matter. So there are three principles of Mayavada Vedanta. First one is that consciousness and matter are co-eternal. That means that consciousness does not give rise to matter, nor does materiality give rise to consciousness, but they are co-emergent and co-eternal. They arise together, and they arise together eternally. There was never a time when they did not arise together. There was never a time when there was only consciousness, especially immaterial consciousness, out of which matter arose. There was never such a time. Matter and consciousness are coeval and co-eternal. Second principle, everything is material. Third principle, there is no gradient of awareness. There is no gradient of awareness means that the act of observation performed by the aeons right now, the aeons in the pleromic core, are observing this experiment from the core. And the act of observation they use, the power of awareness they use to observe this experiment on Earth, is no different than the power of awareness you use to make eggs for breakfast. The power of awareness that you use to look at the palm of your hand is the same as the power of awareness of an aeon looking at you look at the power of your hand. There is no gradient of awareness. So these are the three principles of Mayavada Vedanta. And then there is a fourth, and it's called the rule of endopsyche. Now, the teaching of the rule of endopsyche has just begun. You could say it began today, on September 29th, 2013. Lo and behold. How bizarre is that? The teaching of endopsyche comes from Tripura, comes from Sundari, or Shodashi. She'll get a new name soon. She is one of the Mahavidyas, and she represents the power of beauty and elegance. And I submit to you that psychology can only be true when it is stated in propositions of high beauty and elegance. That is the first rule of endopsyche. If you want to understand the workings of the endopsyche, and you all do want to understand that, I'm sure, then go into that process of learning with the realization that it's all about beauty. That when you actually know how the human psyche works and how the collective psyche is related to the individual psyche and how the subconscious works, you know it in the beauty and elegance of its operations. Now, obviously, humanity is in need of some great correction, as I wrote many years ago in a poem somewhere. Humanity is in need of some great correction, and this great correction begins in the 3 years of correction of the GNE, and this great correction is to entirely correct, rewrite, and reformulate the basic psychology of the human psyche. And all of you who wish can be part of this process. Everything that we have been told about the psyche from 1900 onward is wrong. Almost everything. I would say that there are 3 or 4 possible clues that you might salvage out of Freudian and Jungian psychology. But the problem with Freud and Jung is that those individuals came on the scene in Kali Yuga at a moment, a critical moment, when the nature and function, or what did Jung call it, the structure and function, structure and dynamics of the psyche. It's the title of a book by Jung. They came upon the scene at a moment when the structure and dynamics of the endopsyche needed to be elucidated for humanity to proceed to the next step. This occurred exactly almost at the dawn of the 20th century. Interpretation of Dreams was published in 1900 or 1899. William James, Varieties of Religious Experience in the same year. Cosmic Consciousness by Maurice Buck in the same year. And at that turning point into the 20th century, the time was ripe for humanity to realize and formulate a body of knowledge regarding the structure and dynamics of the psyche, and that was a colossal failure, riddled with deception and disingenuous misdirection. So humanity has been hugely misled on that count. And I declare to you that the moment has now begun to absolutely, fundamentally, totally correct what has been called psychology and arrive at a true psychology, which is simple, lucid, beautiful, elegant, and verifiable. And this is a fantastic prospect that now opens in this Shodashi shift and remains open permanently from this moment on. So let me just share with you the flash insight that I had. It goes like this. Go back to the Kennedy assassination, which is coming up, by the way. The 50th year anniversary is coming up in November. It's interesting that that happens in the last year of correction. I'll have more to say about that. But consider the Kennedy assassination and subsequent events such as 9/11. And consider the way that these events have been studied by diligent and serious-minded people who would like to try to understand what is happening and how these events can be have been perpetrated and by whom and so forth. Well, what very commonly comes up, it's pervasive, it's almost unavoidable, is that those who investigate the assassination of Kennedy and 9/11 and other events of that sort find all kinds of correspondences which they read in terms of symbolic and occult significance that they attribute. I'll give you an example of a recent, because it's good to use a concrete example here, an example of a recent instance of what I'm talking about. There's a fellow teaching on the internet named Neil Kramer, and recently he was talking on Veritas Radio, I think, about the Boston bombing, and you see him apply a vivid illustration of this method of reading occult and symbolic correspondences into these events. For instance, Kramer claimed that the Boston Marathon bombing, which happened on April 15th, could be considered as a sacrifice to the Egyptian goddess Bast, because, according to his research, upon which is based upon what, I don't know, April 15th was traditionally the day of Bast. And so he referred to the Boston Marathon event as a public sacrifice to the old goddess Bast. And he claimed that back in Egypt, Bast, the cat goddess, was considered to be the guardian of the pharaohs, the pharaonic families, and therefore, in his interpretation, the guardians of the imperial ruling order. And so, according to the interpretation of Neil Kramer, which parallels that of many, many other people, an event such as the Boston bombing can be deconstructed to show numerous occult references and correspondences and symbolic messages. That is to say that a traumatic event that occurs in the public eye has been in some manner encoded with these occult and symbolic and archetypal references and allusions. You know what I'm talking about. That method, I don't know what kind of a name you would put on it. That method is widely used. Kramer demonstrates that method in this instance where he interprets the Boston Marathon bombing. This is the problem with that kind of interpretation. Kramer is making a very serious mistake. I mean, he's dead wrong. And the mistake, unfortunately, leads to a series of errors in the human mind. Fundamentally, Kramer is mistaking something that operates in the endopsyche of the human species for a deliberate orchestration coming from certain members of that species. So, Kramer and others who attribute occult and magical knowledge to the perpetrators and psychopaths who caused those events to happen assumes that these psychopaths they are like masters of the universe at some level. They are like very clever, very sophisticated magicians practicing black magic on the human species. And they use these traumatic events to imprint humanity, to imprint society with their agenda. And in doing so, They embed into these events, deliberately and intentionally, these symbolic correspondences, these allusions to dates, and these allusions to various ancient gods and goddesses. So you can speak of a deliberate orchestration of the psychopaths, right? This is what Kramer sees. And he makes his career and his message out of deconstructing what he sees and exposing it to the public. The huge error in this view is that it is not the deliberate orchestration of the psychopaths that causes these elements to appear in these events. The psychopaths are not deliberately encoding these events. It is, in fact, the pattern-detecting capacity of the endopsyche which is capturing those illusions. The psyche itself has a pattern-detecting function, a pattern-detecting application. And so, whenever there is a traumatic event that is actually traumatic, like the murder in public of the President of the United States, the shockwave of that trauma goes into the human endopsyche, and the human endopsyche responds by an activation of its pattern-detecting capacities. The shock of the trauma deliberately inflicted on the human mind to control human beings has an effect that the perpetrators cannot control and which they themselves do not understand. And that effect is, yes, to some measure, it does traumatize people and therefore render them more susceptible to be deceived and led towards certain agendas. It does work, relatively speaking, but there's a deeper effect that trauma has upon the human animal, individually and collectively. And that effect is to awaken or stimulate the pattern-detecting capacity of the endopsyche. Now, no one, as far as I know, has ever put a specific name to what this pattern-detecting capacity is, but it may be compared to an alert system in the psyche. The human psyche is organized in such a way that it has its own powers and properties like the human immune system. And if you introduce into the human body a toxin or some substance that is going to be harmful to the body, the entire immune system of the body will respond with a pattern detecting activity to go and trace the operations of that toxin by the patterns that it produces as it reacts upon the body. You see that? So, trauma produces a fracture pattern in the human psyche, and the endopsyche has a response mechanism to that. So it's the endopsyche itself that recognizes and produces and brings to attention these correspondences. They are not deliberately planted in the psyche by the psychopaths. I assure you that the psychopaths have no such ability to do anything of the sort. And what is seriously wrong and seriously dangerous about the error that Kramer and others are making is that it over-determines the power of the psychopaths. It over-hypes them, and it attributes to them far more power to manipulate the human psyche than they actually have. And of course, they love that. They love that people think erroneously that they are masters of the occult and they are practicing some kind of black magic rituals upon the rest of the human species. They love that. They love it that people think that of them, but it is not true. And I would add, as a final qualification, even if they do conduct such practices, thinking that they are affecting the human psyche by them, they are acting in a complete delusion of their own making. The only thing that makes the black magic of the perpetrators work upon the human psyche is the power of the human psyche itself. that attributes to them an influence that they do not have. It is time to break the spell. It is time to learn what is the endopsyche and how the endopsyche of the human species actually works. And in that learning, which you can undertake right now and happily pursue for the rest of your life, in that learning, you come to see that the endopsyche of the human species is thoroughly and adequately equipped to produce the counter magic against the black magic of the perpetrators. The reason why we have not so far produced the counter magic is because for the last 113 years, since the dawn of the 20th century, psychology has not provided the correct syntax to describe how the psyche actually works. I submit to you that were we to produce that syntax, and it wouldn't be difficult and it wouldn't be complicated, you could probably write it all down on one sheet of paper to model the structure and dynamics of the psyche, as Jung and others have tried to do. Were we to do that, I assure you that instantaneously, with the correct description, would come the application of the power of the psyche against that which attacks the psyche. That is to say, the attacks that come from the sick and demented members of our own species. I leave you with a riddle, with a question. Why would it be that the sick and demented members of our species, which, by the way, were the original subjects of psychology, you know, Jung and Freud studied sick and demented people and schizophrenics and psychotics and hysterics. They didn't study healthy people. And they based their model of the psyche on those sick people. So what kind of model is that going to be? All right, but I ask you, how can it possibly be that the sick and demented members of the human species who intend harm to others have a psychic advantage in perpetrating that harm? How can that be? I leave you with that riddle. And I leave you with the happy and delightful suggestion that on the other side of that riddle is the solution to that weird and bizarre situation. You know, it's not just because the Anthropos is naive and gullible that people who lie and cheat and deceive, and those who even make an agenda out of it, like the Talmudic Jews, have an advantage over ordinary people who don't lie, cheat, and deceive. That's obvious, but it's much deeper than that. The real advantage lies in the unfortunate situation due to the failure of psychology. And that situation is now due to be healed. And the healing comes from this Mahavidya and through the instruction of this Mahavidya, Shodashi. And so in that respect, and consistent with that, with the instruction she gives, she might be called Euphanes. Euphanes. Now, you know, the Greek root eu means health, salubrity, sanity. It's root of the word eugenics, you know. Eugenics means that which leads toward the development of health and salubrity. Phanes is another Greek word from the root phanein, meaning to appear or to reveal or show, such as in the word epiphany. So, her instruction shows or reveals what is healthy, sane, and salubrious. So you might, if you wish, call her Euphanes. You can say that is a title of Shodashi as teacher of the true psychology of the Anthropos. So that brings this briefing to the 50th minute, which leaves me about 20 minutes. I wonder if I can do it in 20 minutes. Well, I'll give it a try. You know, I titled this briefing, The Term is a Tray. It's number 88, and I thought that's kind of a special number, so I might dedicate it to a topic which is a little bit off the GNE, but I'm sure a topic that is supremely on your minds or comes to your mind now and then. And that is the topic of, you know, the Terma of Gaia Awakening and this business of the two parts of the Terma, Planetary Tantra and Kala Tantra. You know, many speakers who give conferences and talks or who put their material on the internet have a practice of speaking as if they were talking to people who didn't know anything about what they have to say. And I understand that in public speaking and in that genre, that is the way to go. I mean, that is a recommended procedure. If I appear at a conference somewhere and I'm going to talk about Planetary Tantra, then I would talk to that audience as if no one in the audience had ever heard what it was, you see. But of course, I don't do that, do I? That's something that I just don't do. And I think, though, I might do it just for a change in the conclusion of this briefing. It's been on my mind for several days now. I don't know why, but I thought to myself, or myself thought to me, hey, John, why don't you just lay out for the world, what is Planetary Tantra in its two components? And say it as if you were speaking to people who never heard about it before, and they were just hearing about it for the first time. So I think I'll try to do that. And the way that I'll do that is to refer to Tibetan tradition going back to Bonpo tradition. The Terma of Gaia Awakening is a wisdom treasure that originates from the intelligence of the earth itself. It is a terma delivered to humanity from the earth and from the living presence of Gaia Sophia in the earth. It is, if you will, the message of the wisdom goddess or earth goddess to humanity, giving the instructions for how to be interactive with her. So it is a wisdom treasure which is called a terma in Tibetan language. Now if you go back and you look at the history of this curious matter of termas, you find that there are two meanings of a terma. Originally, when Buddhism went to Tibet, when it arrived in Tibet, Indian Buddhism arrived there through Padmasambhava, whose actual name was Shakyanata, it encountered a pre-existing indigenous religion known as the Bon or Bonpo, the indigenous shamanic religion of Tibet, as it were. And there are various stories, most of which are very skewed, about the conflict between the incoming paradigm of Buddhism and the existing indigenous spirituality. And they eventually merged, and what came out of that merge is called Tantrayana, or Tibetan Buddhism. Well, the story goes that the Bonpo shamans, when they encountered this wave of Indian Buddhism from the south, were on the defensive against that. And they had to hide their own tradition. And so they actually took scrolls and writings that belonged to their pre-Buddhist tradition, and they hid them in various caves in anticipation of the time when the onslaught of this new religious paradigm would die off, and then they would, future generations would be able to go and find these actual documents and scrolls and artifacts, magical artifacts, hidden in caves in the Himalayas, find them and retrieve the original Bonpo message. You get the picture? And so a terma was initially an object, a physical object. Then when Buddhism took over the terma tradition, it was claimed that a terma, or wisdom treasure, was not actually a literal physical object, but it was a teaching concealed in the mind. And it is said that Padmasambhava and his consort, Yeshe Sogyal, were the first accomplished tantricas to actually use their power of attention to deposit in the mind of humanity, in the endopsyche, certain wisdom treasures, termas, which would then be discovered at a later point or moment in time, many generations afterward, by what is called a tertan. So you can see how the Buddhist tantric conception of the terma was based, which is like metaphorical, was based on a literal interpretation of what a terma is, going back to the situation in which the Bonpo had to hide away their wisdom and their teachings to protect them from destruction. So the gist of this whole story is that a terma can be visualized, if you will, as an artifact or object. You could, for instance, visualize a terma as a scroll, and you could see the scroll unfold in front of your eyes, and there on the yellow or ochre parchment of the scroll in magenta lettering would be the Dakini script in which the terma is written. This is one way in which visualization of termas has been prescribed in modern Tibetan teachings. So you might ask yourself the question, well, can the terma of Gaia Awakening be pictured or visualized in that manner? And the answer is a resounding yes. If you would like to visualize the terma of Gaia Awakening for a concrete knowledge, a concrete realization, no, a concrete apprehension of that terma in its two parts, then I invite you to this short exercise in assisted visualization, or whatever it's called, active imagination in Jungian terms, guided visualization. Allow me to invite you to a little exercise of about 20 minutes of guided visualization. What you picture first is a tray. This is not a large tray. It's like the tray that you would get in a cafeteria where you go to serve yourself food. It's about that size. It's a rectangular tray. And imagine that this tray is suspended directly in front of your face at eye level. And it's about 4 feet distant from you. It's just suspended in midair, vertically, in such a way that the rectangular form is vertical. As I say, it's about the size of a standard serving tray in a school cafeteria. Now visualize this tray as being made of silver. The edges of the tray, the four edges, are slightly ruffled because the silver of the tray has been worked into a border that resembles beautiful cumulus cloud formations. So the border of the tray is a ruffled design resembling a border of clouds. The interior of the tray that you are looking at, suspended vertically in space in front of you, of a somewhat dull but somewhat polished silver, the interior of the tray inside the cloud-lined border is divided into two parts, an upper third, upper two-thirds, and a lower third. Put your attention upon the upper two-thirds of the tray. In the center of the upper two-thirds of the silver tray is a gem. It is a green stone, and it is in the shape of a pentagon with the point downward. This green stone, which is a brilliant yet soft green, is about the size of the distance between your thumb and your forefinger if you make a shape of a U. So take your thumb and forefinger of your right hand and hold them up and make them in the shape of a U, and then take that distance and place it mentally on the tray and locate the pentagonal jewel at that place. Now, around the pentagonal jewel, there are engraved lines in the tray. There are, arching above it, two shapes like commas, two commas with their heads together. The heads of the commas are like the figure 9, except one of them is inverted. So you can conceive that they are two nines, as if they were seen in a mirror. The one on the left is a 9 as you draw a 9, and the one on the right is the mirror reflection of that 9. And so the heads of these two nines, which are like the heads of commas, come together and intersect, making a small vesica Pisces. And then the tails of the commas, the rest of the comma goes up and around and comes down like an arm embracing the pentagonal jewel. So the jewel wears a kind of crown, and the crown consists of these two interlacing nines. And the shape that is formed by the combination of the two nines embracing the pentagram is a heart shape. There is a heart-shaped V at the top, and then the bodies of the two nines come down on either side, and they embrace or enclose but do not touch the pentagonal jewel. So you have a jewel of five faces. You have two nines overarching it. And beneath the jewel, beneath the point of the jewel, there are three lines of Dakini writing inscribed. Three lines. And these three lines are the three instructions of the Diamond Sky Dakinis of Planetary Tantra. One, you cannot become anything but more beautiful. Two, love and the supernatural operate on the same frequencies. And three, samsara and this enlightenment have the same look. And so in its totality, the design that fills the upper two-thirds of the tray consists only of that. Those three lines, the pentagon, which represents the pentagram star of the five diamond sky dakinis, and the two nines, which represent the 18 of the Shakti cluster in its entirety. So there you have it in its entirety. As you gaze at this silver tray with the border of ruffled cumulus clouds, and you focus at first on the upper two-thirds of the surface, what you see in the engraved lines, in the pentagonal jewel, and in the two interlacing nines is the totality of planetary tantra as a visionary artifact. Now you might wonder, well, hold on here a second, there are other elements in planetary tantra. Why are these not represented on the tray? What about the story of the Aeons of Fire, the Sophianic vision story? Planetary tantra operates in the framework of that story. Is there not something on the tray that represents that story? What about the encounter with the organic light? This is essential to planetary tantra and interactive magic with the Earth. And what about the secret Dakini name of VV and the Gayan tantric vow? Are they not represented on this visionary artifact? Well, as far as the story is concerned, it is not represented on this artifact, because the Sophianic vision story is actually another kind of terma. It's the first kind of terma. It's the kind of terma that derives from actual physical artifacts, isn't it? So in December of 1945, when the Nag Hammadi codices were found by an Arab peasant, it was as if that peasant unwittingly discovered a terma. But the particular nature of this terma was such that the one who discovered it was not a Turton, but simply a random person. And it remained for the Turton to come along and see what was in that artifactual terma known as the Nag Hammadi codices. Moreover, the vision story of the Aeons of Fire belongs to humanity. It is the birthright of the entire human species. And that narrative, that sacred narrative, which was the centerpiece of the pagan mysteries, belongs to the entire human race and cannot be categorized merely as a terma. It is the birthright of humanity. Therefore, it is larger than the tray. Therefore, it is not represented in the tray. But considering those other two elements, the presence of the organic light upon the earth, that is to say, the primary substance body of Sophia, and her Dakini name, Vivi, well, you can consider that they are represented in the terma in a subtle way. Raise your eyes again slightly to the large heads of the two nines, the one on the left in the actual form you draw a nine, and the one on the right in the mirrored form. Picture their two heads, which are oval-shaped, commas, intersecting to form an upright vesica. That upright vesica may be said to represent two things. The organic light streaming from this planet, streaming from the womb or matrix or yoni of the goddess herself, and the sonic or acoustic counterpart to that light, which is compressed in her Dakini name. So, in a subtle way, those two elements of planetary tantra are represented or suggested in the visionary artifact. Finally, as regards the Gayan tantric vow, that is not represented on the tray because that is something that you, as a participant in planetary tantra, bring to the tray. You write the vow yourself. You may or may not frame it in the ritual language that I provided when I wrote the Gayan tantric vow framework on October 10th, 2008, a little less than 5 years ago, right here in this room. On that day, I got the secret Dakini name of the Aeon Sophia, and I wrote the formula, optional formula, that you may use when you recite the Gayan tantric vow and commit yourself to interactive magic with the earth in the iron binding ritual. Iron bonding ritual. But that act of commitment is what you bring to the tray, what you bring to the terma, and your vow to her, to the earth goddess, is that which you yourself formulate and pronounce. So that is not found in the terma. Now imagine that you shift your eyes down, and below the three lines which give the three instructions of planetary tantra, there is again a ripple design, like a wave, that divides the upper two-thirds of the tray from the lower third. There is a kind of ripple design, but it's not a steady ripple design. It consists of dots or dashes so that it's porous. There is a boundary between the upper two-thirds and the lower third, but it's a porous boundary. That line and that boundary on the tray corresponds to the rule of the Kalikas. The rule of the Kalikas is the bridge, remember? It's the bridge between the practice of planetary tantra, which is more of a general access, general use magic, and the practice of Kala tantra, which is the warrior magic, including the lethal strike, as well as methods of sexual tantra. So now let your gaze shift down to the lower third of the tray. And there you see, pretty much in the center of that area of the tray, a crescent moon resting on its back. It is quite a thin crescent moon with its two horns pointing upward. And the moon itself, the body of that thin crescent, is made of mother or pearl, of pearl or nakra. And so it makes a contrast against the somewhat dull but somewhat polished silver of the tray. It makes a most subtle contrast when you cast your eyes upon the thin crescent moon formed of abalone or nakra. So just rest your gaze upon that sight for a moment, holding the tray in suspension in front of you, in perfect vertical alignment. And let your gaze settle gently upon that delicate feature, the lunar crescent in mother of pearl. And then look at the two points of the crescent. You can see them both at the same time, because again, the width of the crescent is about the width that is formed if you make a U using your thumb and your index finger. So you can see the two points, the two horns of the crescent pointing up. Now, make the complete circle of the moon with your eyes. Move your gaze slightly upward so that you make the crescent into a complete circle as it would be at the full moon. And at the uppermost point of that circle, at the very top, picture a black pearl. The black pearl is actually suspended between the horns of the lunar crescent. It's a small black pearl embedded in the silver tray. Now, withdraw your gaze a little bit and look at the ensemble. The crescent moon of Nakra holding the bindu, or black drop, of that pearl. And now picture, beneath the crescent moon, engraved in Dakini writing, three lines. These three lines are the three instructions of the Diamond Sky Dakinis for Kala Tantra. And those instructions are, 1, the addiction becomes mastery. 2, disposition is the mother of intent. And 3, desire is the measure of all compassion. These are the three instructions of Kala Tantra. There are three and three only. They are disarmingly simple. Now shift your gaze first to the left, on your left from those three lines, and about 2/3 of the way toward the border of the tray is a simple star, a simple pentagramic star with its point upward, engraved in the silver. Shift your gaze back to the right across the three lines, and at an equal distance from the right-hand border of the tray, as you perceive it, is another identical star. 2 5-pointed stars, small. Now, shift your gaze back to the three lines of writing and look down beneath the three lines, and you will see an infinity symbol centered exactly beneath the crescent moon and aligned to the black pearl. An infinity symbol like two elongated teardrops meeting at a point. That sign of infinity is inscribed in the silver tray. Then bring your gaze down a little bit further after you have taken into your attention the pearl, the crescent moon, the five-pointed stars, points upright to the right and left, the three lines, and the infinity symbol. After you've taken all that into your attention and held it easily and serenely in your intention, you look down just below the center point of the infinity symbol, and there is a black diamond embedded in the tray. Those details of the lower third of the tray represent and comprise the totality of Kala Tantra. Now, Kala Tantra is an option to Planetary Tantra. You can be in Planetary Tantra and not be in Kala Tantra. You take the option when you follow the rule of the Kalikas. However, let me make it crystal clear that if you don't follow the rule of the Kalikas, you're not missing anything in regard to Planetary Tantra. You're not in any way limiting or handicapping your ability to practice Planetary Tantra to its optimal level. Planetary Tantra stands on its own, and you can achieve it optimally on its own. Kala Tantra does not stand on its own. Kala Tantra is a more specialist application of planetary tantra that some individuals may elect to follow. So at this point, I want to complete this briefing, because it's an hour and 20 minutes, and pick up the elements of Kala Tantra in an addendum to this briefing. But as I leave you now with these final words, I leave you beholding the tray, which is the terma. Just as I visualize this tray in my room now, in this afternoon, in Spain, you visualize it when you hear my words. And any time that you visualize this tray and follow the guided visualization in this briefing, you bring the same representation of the terma of Gaia awakening into your attention, and you enforce the presence of that terma in your intention by picturing it as a visionary artifact. And this itself, this method itself, is a tool of planetary tantra and a tool of anchoring. So I leave you with that tool. And those of you who would like to know about the specifics of Kala Tantra can do so by listening to the addendum to this briefing.